The Ebenezer Group News Hour.
Smart mouths turn me off, and I'm beginning to suspect you have a smart mouth.
You're right, I do, but I'm working on changing that.
Who are you anyway? Do you always come equipped with smart remarks, or you're just showing off?
Drop dead.
Ebenezer Group News Hour.
I actually like the way the telephone sounds. I'm kind of like jealous. I think it's a cool vibe.
Okay, great.
Yeah. No. So, how's it going?
Good. It's been fun digging into some of this different stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I think we need it. It's been a really interesting time. And for those who don't know, I guess we could introduce, the reason for doing this. So I don't really know how to start, honestly. Weird.
Man, yeah. I don't know either. It's hard to frame it.
We could just do like a bumper or something. I was thinking like with one of the tracks, and I would just like layer some samples over. So, for context, this is Alex. We do the show. We started it together, and this is kind of like a weird, you know, because we converse, I think, pretty well, and we have this, like, idea that we started this band, and one of the tracks is on the TT comp, Through the Fire and the Flames, but it's like a detective theme band. So we're starting like a news hour based on this like conceptual music project. I think it's like pretty funny. So it's like just putting on the detective hats and trying to go through a few things and just have a fun time. But yeah, the last time I saw you was at the DJE show. Actually, that's not true. I saw you because you lent me some audio equipment because we're working on music. But yeah, that show was pretty amazing. And we could talk about music. We could get into that. But there's a lot of interesting stuff in the news. The Baltimore Bridge collapse.
Yeah.
Would you say these are coastally located problems, or would you say that this is just sort of like imminent of America's collapse in general? Because when I was in San Antonio, it was like everything was ticking like precision. It was just clockwork. It was crazy.
I think a lot of people in the kind of DMV area, there's a lot of lack of maintenance of, I don't know. I think there's a lot of issues in Baltimore and DC kind of area that are not necessarily like all America issues, but I don't know. That bridge collapse does feel pretty kind of a dark symbol.
Yeah, I would say so. It almost feels to me a little bit like, yeah, I don't want to be too conspiratorial. I don't think this is like a Nord 2 pipeline type scenario. I think it's basic, you know, just infrastructure collapsing across America, which is why I think it's increasingly important that during the moment of BlackRock and Larry Fink, that we sort of, I guess, harness our own industrial capacities. Like, there's this, like, trail in Austin. It's, like, this pirate park thing that people just decided they were going to, like, build out their own hiking trail without permission from the city. And it overlooks the entire city. But it was, like, so well done that they just had to concede that it was basically, like, a sanctioned public space. And so I'm starting to think about stuff like that too, because man, it is fucking crazy right now. It's just like, we're both in Los Angeles at the moment. It is, Does it feel, it feels more Babylonian than when I left and when we started, I guess you could say, a project to react against it or something? I don't really know. There's a lot of weird strivery things going on. And then there's just, there's so much going on in geopolitics and the world and, you know, like the tokenization of private, of the private sector and natural resources, you know, creating false scarcity models. It's a really interesting time. Do you think there's a way out? Well, what's your take on all that?
Oh, I mean, I definitely think that the idea of like, yeah, sort of like community infrastructure or like people taking it upon themselves to like actually start rebuilding things or like, I don't know. I know there's people that just like, you know, fill in potholes themselves because the city in LA is not doing it fast enough. And like, you know, just, I mean, that's like a really little thing, but just that kind of drive, because it's just, I don't know. I mean, I think like, it's pretty, I don't know. Yeah. There's so many like projects that are captured by larger forces that I feel like, sorry, I'm trying to phrase this the right way. I mean, I think you can see some of that with certain like, promotion of like unionization, even though I think there's plenty of like very legit reasons for people to want to like, you know, do collective bargaining with their, you know, employers, but like, you know, the whatever hot union summer or any of those kind of things, when it's like a movement like that, there's like, there's top down aspects to it that are,
oh, yeah,
that are sus inherently. And anyone who like traces where money comes from or thinks about that kind of stuff, like gets a kind of ick about that stuff, even though like, obviously like, yeah, anyone, I mean,
so wait, who was funding the hot labor summer? Because I remember, didn't somebody dig into that guy Smalls and found some like kind of suspicious funding from that?
Oh yeah, totally. Sorry. I don't have the exact like on that one, but yes, there's weird funding around that. And just like really big unions, like, and that kind of like, it's sort of like overemphasis on the, on unionization in like sectors of industry where it doesn't matter that much or whatever. I mean, you know, it's kind of a tired topic, but just like, you know, journalists, whatever, you know, I'm not trying to get back into barista shit, whatever, but that kind of stripper, barista, journalist, you know, those zones. It's just, there's anyway, but I think like, yeah, there's just like, there's so obviously a, cause yeah, I mean, I've been like driving a taxi at LAX for like the last year and a half, and I talk to all kinds of different people, and you know, there is a fear of a loss of certain like skill sets in a lot of different industries. Like I'll talk to people where they're like, after COVID, all the competent old people retired and my industry is hanging on by a thread, and there's not enough young people trained to take it over. And I'm worried that it's not going to, you know, continue at the same level. And that's like across a lot of different, you know, industries. And the ones where people do seem to be like more confident kind of in the continuation are ones that are not necessarily as linked to the maintenance of a lot of important things. They're more right, like kind of speculative and kind of, you know, things that could lead somewhere, biotech, things that could, you know, could have big returns, but it's just like, you know, people that are more on the level of like, they work on like ships and docks and those kind of things. It's like, yeah, they're like really worried about crumbling infrastructure, really worried about like, there aren't enough engineers, there aren't enough.
The ships and docks union thing is really interesting because in the East Coast, it was controlled by the mafia. In the West Coast, the Longshoremen Union was controlled by CPUSA, the Communist Party USA. A friend of mine who's an old head surfer, you know, Mario Tronti sort of autonomia Marxist guy, he's like, you know, he likes Trump, you know, he's like a, he's really interesting. He talks about, we talk about Nick Land and stuff. He talks about this kind of thing a lot. Now he's like a bartender because he's just like, I'm basically over it. You know, and he's, yeah, it's a really interesting, I mean, the whole, it's basically a maxim at this point, the whole like, DJs on ketamine, creative influencers, hey, is there a doctor around kind of thing? But yeah, it's really funny. I was like, the new season of, Love on the Spectrum, which is the TV show about autistic people going on blind dates and stuff. One of the guys who's like really into like medieval, like, history and swords and shit. Every time, like, he asks a girl what she does, he goes, "Oh, that's a good job. It's not going to be obsolete soon." It's really funny. It's like, that's like a thing he says on every single date. He's like, "Oh, people are always going to need those." You know, it's like really funny.
Yeah.
He's got this like funny long, like kind of like mullet haircut. I also noticed that like every one of the moms is like really attractive. So there might be some kind of correlation between autism and having like a hot mom or like a MILF or something. Like I was starting to think about that because my mom's pretty attractive and, you know, for someone her age.
Yeah.
And I'm a, you know, I'm a little spurgy. So yeah, it's fucking funny. No, but yeah, it's the breakdown is really sort of interesting and finding sort of like a destituent. You know, it's like you go to a DIY show, like went to this, like, I don't know what kind of music you call it. It's like, kind of sounds like Dinosaur Jr. or something, but like, there's all these like anarchy symbols and there's this guy wearing a shirt that said like, "Make Orwell fiction again." And like people talking about fucking astrology. And I'm just like, what about nuclear reactors in your backyard? Why are we not crafting massive dub sound systems that we can, you know, in our hobby shops? Like, you know, it's just so strange how many powerful forces of production are out there that we're not tackling ourselves. You know, like I was just at the Chinati Foundation and Donald Judd built all his own furniture. And his furniture is actually really comfortable. It's like really basic looking, but I'm sort of like, yeah, let's get into that hobby shop mindset. I'm into that.
Yeah, I think one thing just from a kind of untangling ideological, whatever meme plexi type shit is that unfortunately a lot of the people that are on the open to nuclear reactor, open to massive building, that kind of thing, they get hoovered up into the libertarian. It's a little bit kind of like EAC SF Venture-y preys on some of that impulse of like, let's build Peter Thiel industry again, build, you know, like, you know, that's sort of their like the attractive part of their message is like, you know, we fuck soft, you know, social sciences and that kind of stuff. We want to do hard, you know, we want the, you know, they go after that kind of impulse of people who are sick of what they see as whatever, like bureaucracy and whatever. You can see some of it in YIMBY type stuff where it's like, why can't there be mega structures everywhere? Which is like, there is a little bit of overlap between it, but again, there's like YIMBY, that's like such a perverted, like progressive, weird center progressive version of this, which I do think that like the what you're describing and the way that it's kind of I guess more true to like original parts of acceleration or like kind of whatever, not to put it in like hard left, but just whatever, the Edberg side of things, as opposed to the like YIMBY EAC SF, like, or like even the what's it called, that city they're building out in Northern California.
Oh, Praxis.
No, Praxis, that's a great example. I'm talking about the one where they've bought all the land in that county. They were using some kind of name like,
I think they're trying to do something like that in Montana too. There's like a homesteading project.
It's like a Mark Andreessen and Steve Jobs' wife, and they bought like a crazy amount of farmland kind of northeast of the bay, and they did it all with this name that's sorry, I'm blanking on the name, but it's like something where it's like, you know, the something group, Flannery group, whatever, and they just bought all this land. No one knew what it was for, and now they've like, once they got revealed publicly, now they have like a campaign. I forget if it's called like California Forward or something, but it's like this Czech dude who's like super into the culture of Silicon Valley and wants to build basically a new SF where they build it from the ground up, and so they don't have to deal with.
I remember this. This is where they were trying to buy out farmers. So yeah, they're pressuring farmers to sell up. You know, this is a really interesting thing. And I've been thinking about this a lot too, how there's like this criticism of like, you know, farmers as being, you know, part of like the bourgeoisie or whatever, some stupid thing. But that's actually not true, because in order, like farmers are basically rentiers of their tools to keep their property maintenance high enough to be valuable within the basic like structure of commodity form and value. So a lot of times these farmers will be sitting on like, you know, millions and millions of dollars of plots of land, but they're living on like tiny trailers on that land. And then a way for them to get into that sort of like higher class is they're basically selling out their property to these massive corporations, people like the Flannery groups, like these Silicon, who are building solar panels and doing like green energy experiments, but they're not even allowed to live on their land. So it basically takes them like totally out of the agriculture game entirely, which I think is like a really interesting thing as well. Yeah, it's super fucked up. I remember reading about this last year. Not a lot of people know about that either, but yeah, this, it's like this utopian city.
In terms of a point of overlap between maybe some of this more like libertarian utopia and then also this kind of industry for all, in small industry, like more access to useful, meaningful technology that you're describing, I do think that like certain overlaps would be, although it's just, it's really dangerous because it is around something that can potentially be so misused or so addictive or whatever. But like, you know, like those kind of like dreams of like, what if we could get all the like autistic kids who loved playing StarCraft and League of Legends to be doing like real farming over their computer that or whatever, you know, like instead of being little drone strikers, if they could be doing like useful industrial tasks, but that were like gamified in some way. But at the same time, it's just like, I really don't trust the people who design any of those games to be like doing it to like actually a good use. But I don't know, that would sort of be like a good overlap or something.
I think so, too. It's really sort of strange. And I've actually been kind of like diving into indigenous harvesting and biodiversity practices and its influence on like complexity and cybernetic theory and people like Claude Shannon and the Shannon Weaver method. And I just recorded like a whole thing on this, but it's actually like really interesting to see how so many of these top-down cultures are just like, they've just been raping these methods of feedback and like means testing that have already been sort of like established on the bottom. It's a really strange, like strange phenomena. So like some of this like stuff, like it kind of sounds like a little bit woke or whatever, but like there's actually like a lot of truth to that. But yeah, this whole like sort of establishing these cities thing, I think is kind of, it's really fucking weird to me, because it's like, don't you guys already have everything anyway? Like, I guess you could say like they're trying to escape like urban blight and crime and, you know, whatnot. But it's just kind of like weird to me. I don't really know.
Well, a lot of them I think are like, and I don't really, I haven't put enough thought into it, or I'm not like maybe as ordered enough of a thinker to deal with this idea, but I feel like there's a fetish for like first principles among those people. And I feel like they're really attracted to the idea of like, you know, building it from the ground up in this way and all the things you can avoid, you know, all the traps you can avoid. Because yes, it's true. Like all of our systems are weighed down with insane parasitic aspects of like, you know, education, the amount of money spent on administration, medicine, the amount of money spent on administration, just this insane bloat. So it's like that part, I mean, I totally agree with, you know.
Yeah, I do too.
And a lot of times like people in unions and stuff get in the position of having to be bloat defenders, even though on the ground in real life, they know the bloat is bad.
Right.
Which, and it's just really, yeah, it's just a kind of, because they can't trust the bloat cutters, you know? So it's like, if each side could trust the ones that determine, you know, it's like, how do you know the pure ones that are going to determine what actually is waste? Yeah. I don't know. The idea of like,
I also think a big problem is that the labor unions are so embedded with the state at this point. You know, they're basically just, I mean, they're state lobbyists. They love the state. the state is what allows these labor unions to even exist in the first place. So there is a kind of exchange or relationship that actually kind of happened because the Democrats took over the labor unions from the Republicans, and who were the first people vying for labor rights? It was actually the Unitarian and progressive Protestant ministers, so it's like
with some of this stuff, you have to understand it as like corruptions of progressivism or.
Well, the progressivism also was corrupted by this idea that if you didn't want full employment and you didn't want to become a state bureaucrat, you were essentially a homosexual, which is like why, during the FDR administration, if you were working in a factory and you were like lobbying for some sort of like, right to work less than 40 hours a week, it was basically a top-down command to every single like head of industrial sectors that like your employees were gay. Like that was like a tactic that they would use
to fire people or to.
To fire people and like socially slander and sanction them within the workforce, which I think is kind of funny because, it's like now the Democrats are like, oh, we can carpet bomb whoever we want because they don't believe in like LGBTQ. And it's like, so it's like they've adopted, it's kind of a cliche.
Either side
of it,
it's just about ostracization and identifying the most useful chunk.
Right. So it is kind of, I think, It's a strange exchange, that we've.
Yeah. Well, going back really quick to the, this isn't exactly what you were talking about, but I'm curious what you think about, like, one of the things that I think is going to be really kind of confusing to deal with coming up is this kind of, because you were mentioning the influence of, like, the indigenous agriculture stuff with the Claude Shannon or whatever, right? So this is a little bit different, but just. I think it is going to be really interesting, this kind of like all this like token indigenous like land stewardship stuff where it's like not actually organic. It's like it's basically just some kind of like weird Greta situation where they just like pick, a kid out of a hat or who like goes to their, schools or whatever. And then they are like, you are the, activist that represents, land stewardship of the Amazon or whatever. And then it's like this weird transnational thing where they like, they've been doing this with like Brazil where it's like, they're trying to like make, and it's like, on one level, I sort of understand the, trying to fight like, deforestation with any weapon possible, but it's just like this idea of it almost like fucks with national sovereignty in weird ways where it'll be like, the UN recognizes this person as a regional climate steward of the area because the indigenous like have this like claim to that land that isn't actually a real claim because it's like more of like this like symbolic claim or something. And so I feel like separating like and then you come up into these really funny versions of this where it's like it'll be like what does the actual like tribe want to do in Canada? They want to like build big ass skyscrapers on their land or something, but then like all the like liberals were like thinking that they were going to be trying to do land stewardship, and then they have to like turn against them after they've held them up as. I don't know if that's like convoluted.
No, it's not convoluted at all. They're doing it because they don't want economic sovereignty for minorities. It's basically the same thing that's going on in Gaza right now, where it's like, so Hamas was funded by the Likud party. They were completely held up after, there's a lot of evidence that they assassinated the left labor leader. Labor Zionist head of state in the 90s. And so what happens is they have the ability to turn off their electricity and their internet. You can say, well, Hamas controls the region, but that's not exactly true because the settlers basically control all the infrastructure. They're just the ones, I guess you could say, benefiting from this from the destabilization, because obviously like they make a lot of money themselves, like within that group. But it, you know, it's just so fucking crazy to me, you know, when you think about stuff like economic sovereignty and in the possibility of something like that. But at this point, it's like all culture has to come from like that position at this point. Like we can't have, like the reason why shit sucks so bad is because people are, A, they're not willing to say no. And I understand it's like similar to the Native Americans. It's like, well, if you've been beaten down so bad for so long, you're going to take the symbolic victory because you'll do anything it takes to just feel good, even temporarily. So like, I want to like say that I understand that. And increasingly, as Russell Means noted, we're all becoming Native Americans. So, you know, we're going to, like, people are going to take the symbolic victory of like, oh, I got in some fucking like interview magazine or something, you know, even though it's like these.
Yeah, well, there's also this whole thing of the choice between like symbolic victory sort of purity thing that's more international versus sort of grimy union-esque, just like corrupt, like patronage, big boss type thing where it's like, yeah, whatever, casino, blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying that's necessarily as bad as I'm making it out. There's aspects about like, and this relates to some of the stuff maybe we'll talk about it in a sec with Haiti, but like where the line between like someone being a gang leader, a community leader, a whatever proto politician, or it's very blurry. Cause I feel like with a lot of stuff with like, at least from an outside perspective with like Native Americans, I mean, whatever, same with Hamas or same with, it seems very like concentrated. Like there's just like a really small kind of like fat elite in it that like that benefits a lot from most of the money and everything filters through them, you know. And then so it's like I can see why someone would be attracted to the kind of like idealistic symbolic side of things as opposed to the grimy patronage distribution, kind of like old school Tamami almost vibe.
That's a good point.
So like, yeah, I can see, yeah, it's kind of a hard thing to be in between.
It's a very hard thing to be in between because also it's the idea of selling out is really glorified.
And NGOs look really good when you're younger sometimes. I think for some people, they can look a lot cleaner.
Right.
And you, because you can be at the benefiting end of them and they can be the thing that provided the, you know, space for you to be fucking reading books in or whatever. Like they can be doing these things for you. Yeah, it's crazy thinking about like, you know, all the times the ADL would somehow be at our high school or something, or like whatever, just weird ways that things wiggle in. And then you're like,
especially after 9/11,
conflict mediation class by the ADL is totally neutral.
Yeah, it that was actually really wild. I remember I remember all of that actually, like, you know, post 9/11 there was a lot of strange activity there, you know, in public high schools especially, you know. It was even in a place in California, in Los Angeles, which is nominally a very liberal place. I remember there was like a lot of pressure even to be like pro Iraq war in a lot of ways back then. Like I think President Bush at that point had like a really high approval rating in California.
So, yeah.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, it's, you know, it is interesting to see how these like NGOs become ideological bastions that can sort of just like flip people's perception who I guess you could say normally wouldn't have, I don't know, followed that line of thinking or logic or I don't know, like value system or whatever. It's really weird.
And they're even the idea in the name of an NGO is just already so fake in the sense of like, oh, it's non-governmental, but like, no, it's totally like often funded, you know, partially by the government and like existing to fill gaps that the government's like receding from or whatever, you know. It's like, it's so not separable in a way just this idea, the civic sphere or something is so fake today. It's like, it's, Same with, unfortunately, same with a lot of churches and religious groups, you know, they're just as penetrated, you know, they're just as, in a lot of cases, you know, like not, you know, obviously there's, you know, counterexamples with like ones that are cut off from larger sources of funding, but the ones that are, you
like
know,
the Anabaptists or something.
Yeah. I mean, again, going back to just like that, that kind of useful Steve Coakley view of just the oath takers, like people within professional organizations, people within organizations that can lose some form of accreditation, that can be centrally messaged to. Like I had a good conversation with this this nurse who had like moved into kind of like I guess like risk calculation, not exactly like actuary work, but something that's like sort of similar to that. But she had been kind of like frontline during COVID and all this stuff, and she was like super cool and was basically, you know, saying all the same shit that everyone knew about, like, yeah, I totally worked in, you know, like empty hospitals that claim they were full and blah blah blah. And you know, but her point was, you know, it's all about like the power of these accreditation organizations. The losing of accreditation. So anything where it's these, you know, and it penetrates all the things that are really important, accounting, lawyers, doctors, anything where it's just these, they have to do continuing education, they're part of a society, and they can be revoked, they can lose that, you know? And I don't know, I guess just like that model extends to a lot of things, I think, just in the sense of like, once you've, once you control kind of like that, then it's like, everyone who's part of that can lose their livelihood because they can no longer be their profession.
Right. You know, it's interesting you brought up Steve Coakley, but what do you think of, so we could segue a little bit into Haiti or Victoria Nuland. Who is Victoria Nuland's replacement? Because he seems like a really shady, little known character.
I mean, he's the guy who, I don't know if he's like, I think he's little known in a, maybe like a media way, but I mean, he's definitely like, he's been around and been present. And like, he was the Obama, he was like the architect of the pivot to Asia Obama policy. That kind of, I guess sort of was maybe considered like a failure of Obama's administration or like, you know, but just kind of like the, hopefully we're going to turn away from the Middle East. And even though that didn't happen and, you know, maybe, I mean, it's funny. Cause I feel like from, thinking about like pre-Trump, it's kind of hard to, I don't think of like an Obama administration person as a China hawk. Just in the sense that because we're used to like everything kind of getting ramped up post Trump because he like actually engaged China in a real way that then made it so that kind of opened the door for them to for almost like a new consensus on China, which I mean I think there's a lot of negatives to that as well, even though I think it appeared really positive at the beginning, just because I mean it's complex because there's just like,
well, it's complex it kinda, like, because because he was imposing a kind of centralized tariff system on them. That was, you know, he was basically just upping the trade demands in order to, like, I don't know, spur a kind of like nationalization of the economic sector in America, which kind of at the time looks like socialism, basically, So because he wasn't
good, but I just mean the part that I'm now more suspicious of is the like more like whatever military side of the China hawk thing, as opposed to just being like aggressive about
trade.
Or it was kind of like there needed to be a reckoning about the like penetration of China into the US, and that was really important, but that's kind of more about a betrayal of our own institutions and elites and stuff than it is about like China, because like every country should strategically should try to penetrate every other country. You know what I mean? It's not weird that they were doing that. It's just about which of our people were most susceptible to that. You know what I mean?
Right.
And which of our sectors were most susceptible to that, which like obviously education was incredibly susceptible to that with like all the different, you know, institutes of the different colleges and all the different, all the money they, you know, depend on from Chinese nationals that are often getting like degrees that they're not even whatever doing the work on and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, going back to the like
Kirk Campbell.
Yeah. Kirk Campbell. So yeah, he was kind of like the architect of the pivot to Asia under Obama. And then he's been in the Biden administration as the main Asia hand. But yeah, basically Victoria Nuland resigned recently, although it was such a kind of sudden resignation and under pretty negative circumstances for her main project that she was involved in, which is support of Ukraine. And so it looks like it was potentially a forced resignation. Yeah, I mean, it seems significant in the sense that things are going so bad in Ukraine that it is potentially just being like kind of held together so that it doesn't fall apart before the election, but it's on the verge of falling apart. And there was kind of weird blustery stuff from Macron about, oh, there, maybe we'll do like NATO troops in Ukraine, but that seems to be withdrawn. And Victoria Nuland was like kind of all in on the, totally failed Ukraine offensive that kind of never materialized and, resulted in like no change in kind of like the borders of the conflict, if anything, like further caving in. And yeah, it seems like, Russia is basically saying like, okay, now we're actually going to start engaging, we haven't been really engaging before. So I don't know. I would imagine that it's possible for it to kind of fall apart somewhat quickly, especially with the QAnon super far right or libertarian part of the Republicans actually does block Ukraine funding. I think that would be awesome. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like that it also seems like a kind of like the center always is going to, get more funding for wars. So I would imagine that the funding could be released, but I don't think it even matters because they don't have enough missiles. They don't have enough artillery. They're trying to like buy shells from Sudan and Pakistan and cobble together all the, it's crazy how much of a spotlight it puts on the West's kind of lack of industrial power that we can't even produce enough ammo right for the war.
Yeah, no, it's completely true, all of that. It's also a really interesting thing because it brings up a lot of really weird things, that you just mentioned about like our lack of power and how we get sort of funding for these wars and stuff. And it's like if you look at Haiti, for example, I think Haiti's a really interesting example because, there's this idea that like we have to intervene in Haiti because it's chaos. And, obviously we created a lot of the problem dating all the way back to Papa Doc, and so now we have this like ex cop, Jimmy Barbecue Chevrier, who's basically a warlord who's taken over as head of the country. And it doesn't seem like what's going on in the Sahel because, I think Burkina Faso is really interesting as well. I'm a big fan of their new leader.
The situation in Haiti is really, really hard to parse from outside. And it is one of those situations where you kind of have to deal with like extremely polarized information that, really has to be taken with a grain of salt.
Right.
I mean, obviously the I've been looking at like basically the pro Chevalier side of things, which is like I would say that kind of anti-imperialist left, as well as there's no anti-imperialist right that cares about Haiti because they're too racist about it or
right,
whatever.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Yeah, but the anti-imperialist kind of left, the type of people that are super I don't mean this in a negative way, but like just super like pro Putin, pro Assad, pro any, any anti whatever, pro multipolarity, anti Western or whatever. So there's two journalists, this guy, Kim Ives, who writes for Haiti Liberté. And then this guy, Dan Cohen. And they're kind of like a source of a lot of the, you know, interviews with Chevalier where he kind of like, where he's, you know, like, and yeah, I mean, you know, obviously it's the kind of thing where it is very sus the way that like, just being on Twitter, the amount of just like cannibal, Haiti, cannibal, warlord, gang, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, yeah, it does feel really strong, like the propaganda. With that said, you know, it's pretty crazy when you hear about, it's like, you know, his group, like the G9 or whatever, where it's just like, it was a coalition of like anti, you know, non-violent groups with like violent gangs. And you're like, whoa, like, you know,
it doesn't seem to have like the ideological tethering in order to suppress, you know, you could say factions that would be essentially like violent against the civic population of Haiti itself. As like, if you look at like Burkina Faso, for example, Ibrahim Traore is like a trained, you know, Marxist basically. So he has this like ideological tethering that's sort of rooted in this like almost like quasi religious morality that he got from Thomas Sankara, who was like really Christian, for example. And Traore is also a Muslim. Which is kind of interesting too, because after Sankara, Burkina Faso, when it was Upper Volta, was majority Muslim country, and he kind of converted most of the country to Roman Catholicism. Or he didn't convert them; they actually chose to convert to Christianity on their own, which I think is really interesting. But you know, it's like the former U.S. ambassador to Haiti, James Foley. He oversaw the 2004 coup, and basically he's been talking for like the Biden administration to intervene in Haiti as well. And it's like, I feel like when you have gangs and you're framing it as like this gang thing there, but at the same time, you have to be balanced because there is some truth to the fact that like, these are not the same kinds of, this isn't the same situation that's going down in the Sahel where they're, you know, throwing out the French forces and you know,
yeah, trying. It's also not a situation where they can like hire foreign mercenaries or they definitely, the only people that can hire the foreign mercenaries are the like, you know, what is his name? Is it like Gilbert Biggio or whatever? Or like those type of like the people that own there's like the private port in Haiti. That's like the only, that probably where all the weapons are coming in through. Like, I don't know if it's called like, not Latito or Lit, it's yeah, La something. And it's it's kind of like the Syrian Palestinian Lebanese.
Right. Well, Biggio is the consul to Israel as well.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I mean Jewish Syrian, whatever. And Haiti has a target on it from Canada, France, and the US, and a lot of it is enacted through NGOs. So, I mean, I think the part of the Chevalier story that is really interesting, if it's true, is the his interaction with this guy, Pierre Esperance, is pretty interesting. This guy is like, he's part of this big NGO, and there's like a point where he was like, you know, trying to, bribe Chevalier with like doing this hit so that he could avoid being like fingered in this massacre that he was not really involved in. It was more like a situation where like he had forces adjacent to it that were like holding down an area, and it like happened next to him. It's like hard to know what to believe in this situation, but this guy's worth looking into. And you know, there's a lot of conflicting. I mean, I've just been going through a lot of stuff on Twitter with like just reading Haitians arguing with each other, where it's like, you know, and a lot of them will be like, yes, this is true about what the pro Chevalier people are saying, but then still he was like going into this area and like, you know, extracting rent in this way from the people. I mean, yeah, it's kind of like when you're a leader in that kind of situation, you are probably doing a lot of things that look bad in human rights accounting, but it's kind of like, if we are to do fair human rights accounting, then we also have to be looking at like NGOs and gun importing and all that shit. So like,
yeah, no, Pierre Esperance, he's like a quote unquote human rights defender.
Exactly. But there's but it seems like he's yeah, pretty dirty and involved in.
Right.
Yeah. So it's like, which I mean, obviously, we know that like in Haiti that they have so many issues with NGOs, so many issues with the UN, you know, being the ones that are, you know, causing terrible problems, you know, for them, even though whatever, there's, you know, ways in which they're, you know, dependent. But yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I do. And, you know, the idea, I think it's very like transparent. Also this idea of like, oh, like Kenya or something, which is like, you know, it's just like the U.S. just acting through, you know, I mean, Kenya is the most, gets the most funding from the U.S. besides Egypt and Africa. You know, it's just kind of like a mask to wear. And yeah, I would say, even though I don't know that much about it, just like the way that the propaganda is on it, like I'm, yeah, I would definitely lean on the distrustful side of like, it seems to be, it's overemphasis on chaos, chaos, gangs. We need intervention and order. They can't work it out themselves, blah, blah, blah. It's like,
well, that's like the right wing argument, you know, which is why their interest in Haiti is basically, you know, it kind of creates, I don't know, a haven for more imperialism, which is what they want. You know, because they, you know, as where they don't really talk very much about this in the case of, you know, Niger or the Sahel, because there's like obvious competency to the coups and military situation and rebellion. And then there's like this whole thing that they also like to do where they're like, no Marxist could ever be manly or tough or handsome. It's like Abraham Traore is pretty fucking badass. I don't know. He looks pretty fucking cool to me, you know, like that's like where they've like eugenic.
Yeah. I mean, I do think one of the things that is that kind of like really unfortunate sort of double bind thing is that, I mean, sometimes with arguments, there's like the kind of the magnetic draw of like, if you just out it, if you go further and more extreme in a certain way, it can, like, there is this art, like the UN is so fucked up in Haiti that it's like, you can almost make the argument that like a Blackwater would do a better job or something, but it's just like, you know, at that point, it, you know, like, I don't know. It's like, I don't want to, I can't go down that, but it's like, there is a, it's that same thing that's like similar to the kind of problems of like, which bloat do you cut? Which corruption do you cut? And it's like, yeah, there is like a kind of.
But it's actually, it's weird though, because the UN stabilization mission supposedly ended in 2017, I think. You know, because it, a big part of it was because of the earthquake, which is one of like the main reasons they were able to do so many like extracting efforts of resources.
Oh yeah, and I mean that. I mean that's basically like, I mean, Haiti's got so much like, you know, untapped oil, natural gas, gold, and it's like, it also is, you know, one of the, you know, 11 countries that recognizes Taiwan, so it's a big like pawn in the kind of China, like if it was to, you know, obviously you couldn't allow like Belt and Road to happen in Haiti or something, you know, like that would be, you know, really dangerous.
Well, it could happen, but they would have to take Taiwan. Yeah, they would have to take Taiwan first and then impose that on Haiti. And then you could say the pretext would be that is that, oh, this isn't, you know, an imperial effort because they were supporting the imperialists themselves, blah, blah, blah. You know, like there's all kinds of justifications for strange alliances that, you know, because the PRC, ultimately, there is like this kind of like Maoist pragmatism based on like, you know, their relationship with like Richard Nixon, for example, you know, like yeah. That's a perfect, I mean, that's like the shining example of their form of opportunism. And also, interesting enough, when you look at the Sea Lai Buddhist temple scandals, the Charlie Tree stuff, the Democratic National Convention being strapped for cash in the 90s and selling high security clearance passes to these shady businessman types who were then, you know, in Indonesia, like Johnny Wang and stuff, and they were selling that back to like China, which is how they were able to develop, you know, stealth bombers and steal a lot of our sort of I don't know, you could say covert military, just more like on the industrial side of like how to manufacture certain types of military technologies and encryption and cryptography. That was actually like, there's like a big part in that too. But at the end of the day, it's like a lot of the framing of that is like, look, you see, like, look how shady they're. It's like, no, they're just water seeking their own advantage. It's like, hey, look, if I was the head of a nation and I was like, these guys are like, hey, we'll sell you this out if you give us some money, I'd be like, fuck yeah. You know, like, of course I'm going to take that strategic advantage. Like, you'd have to be a fucking idiot not to. And ultimately, who was doing the selling here? Janet Reno was overlooking a lot of this stuff purposely because her pockets were tied up in all of it. You know, it's like at the end of the
day. It's fundamentally rational, and it's not, it's not really particularly ideological. It's just, and I think that a lot of times we're the ones that have these kind of weird, twisted, competing knots within our own system that are still doing sort of their own version of the same thing of like, but they just have more kind of weird conflicts with each other that can create canceling outs of, you know, of aims, where it'll be like, you know, obviously there's tensions between between State Department, between Pentagon, between DOD, whatever, like in terms of what they prioritize, in terms of, you know, what they think deserves focus and money and all that stuff. And it's like, we're very, we've got a lot of things pulling in different directions.
Yeah, no, definitely. It is a really kind of weird situation. But it's also a situation that I think can bear fruit in certain regards too, if we, you know, because it's also just like, you know, I think there's a lot of criticisms of parapolitics now, and that it wasn't a good, it's not like a viable solution to, I don't know, you could say the stalemate of the contemporary political situation. But I do think industry is an interesting example of that. But you bring up a good point about like the way that these kind of like micro industrial, like niche, you could say almost in, democratized forms of solutionism can be co-opted by Silicon Valley and used to their own ends to create these like, you know, free seasteading city states and whatnot.
Yeah. And I don't want to just say co-opted, because I do think that like, some of it is there at the impulse of it at the beginning, just in the sense of like that, like, yeah, there are these, you know, even when one wants to, you know, critique some of this stuff, like there are like, yeah, there are a lot of anarchists and libertarian types interested in sovereignty. And in that, on certain levels, if you're on a technological end of that, and it's not just this kind of like, because now there's all this, just this kind of like bullshit sort of lightweight crypto version of that, where it's just like someone can signal all that shit, but it's not real. But like people who like, whatever, just like, you know, want to fucking operate ham radio or whatever, do all these fucking things that like would be able to stay up in a collapse or whatever. Some of this kind of like certain sides of like, prepperism and certain sides of like, there is, I mean, and you know, the better side of anarchy in the sense of like that quest for radical sovereignty or something, it's like that can like, yeah, there is a way in which like hopefully that could I think they just don't believe that anyone who, I mean, I guess it's sort of like it's a little bit maybe communist side to have to like sort of prove to them that they do like kind of want this, don't want just like a kind of, I don't know, just like kind of like they're fixated on the kind of authoritarian nightmare for good reasons. We do live in a kind of whatever, there is this techno-fascist aspect to what we live in, but it's like them realizing that
I think part of it is that we're sort of looking at this really strange situation where I think, you know, and you can kind of see this with like MAGA communists and how they're trying to, I guess you could say, build these memeified inroads with some libertarian thought, like Ron Paul Maoism. I do think there has to be a kind of like, you have to submerge the individual kind of caprices within libertarianism in order to like actually realize it as an outcome. And part of that is like merging a bit of it with, I don't know, Marxism, and even like right libertarians like Hans Hermann Hoppe have talked about, you know, a lot of the, I don't know if you've ever heard any of his lectures on Marxism and their compatibilities with libertarianism. They're actually they're quite good, I think. But, you know, as somebody who considers myself to be a bit of a libertarian, you know, I like Ron Paul. I also like Marx. You know, it's interesting. It's interesting to see this tendency arise, because sure, I have contentions with some of it, whatever, some of the tactics, but I also acknowledge that these are evolving platforms.
Because and that bridge building is pragmatic, really, and is really important necessary. And like, I mean, I think it's also just about like, I think on the kind of like the communists trying to bridge with libertarian side, it's like, I think there's an importance of kind of demonstration of technical aptitude in a way, because I do think that there is like, I mean, there's definitely, you know, a lot of.
But how do you feel about this? Because here's an argument against people who are like decelerationists. So if you're a decelerationist, the point is that you're ceding technical expertise to the people at the top, who are often alienated from the production that of the sort of surplus value that they technically extract and own from what you could call like the workers or whatever. You know, it's like to me, it's like you look at somebody like Joe Biden, he's a complete retard. He has no idea how to run anything. Like I would almost wager almost like any regular person would be a better president than him, you know, based on the fact that they're not career politicians. They're not just like these stewards of the state. So it is kind of like an interesting thing to think about that as well. Just like who can actually foment these industrial processes and how we can like, you know, expand them. And part of it needs, I guess you can say, a kind of mass ideological structuring. Don't get me wrong. I think that there's a lot of issues with Marxism. I'm not going to sit there and say he got everything 100% right, but there has to be something, you know, like that's like historical that we can point to. And, it, you know, Michael Hudson talks about this. He says, well, Marx is kind of the person who ended classical economics because he's the last classical economist. So if we're going to look to classical economics to sort of solve these problems, it's like, what are we going to look towards? Are we going to look towards like Jeremy Bentham, or are we going to, you know, actually look towards things that, you know, and there's, I mean, but also you could say there's people, even though like the Keynesians fucked everything up in a lot of ways and didn't get a lot of things right and, you know, influenced, you know, FDR in really nefarious, fucked up ways, they still made some good points early on. It's just, how do we like steer this thing in the right direction? And I think it's definitely possible, but I don't think it's possible in like mega cities. You know what I mean? Like, I think that sustainability can exist, but it's also really interesting because like you look at like post-nihilist, like I've been reading like, you know, gender nihilistic, like post-left anarchy stuff from like a Native American perspective, like Klee Benali, who just died. And it is he really hates Marxism and leftism and socialism because of its like authoritarian nature, and is like really critical of any like indigenous effort to, because he just says it's like, you know, the words of a dead white guy, like all leftism is just that. So like, why do we have to tack on, you know? But then it goes into this like Frank Wilder thing of like, you know, Afro pessimism, that like you'll never stop struggling against colonialism. Therefore, like the struggle is what, you know, gives you your sort of like sense of identity or spiritual like weight. Ooh,
I don't know. There's something in that that really, really feels dangerous and life sapping.
I agree.
And turns me off. And it also reminds me of like, kind of like maybe the worst side of certain, it feels like reanimation of something dead in a way. And it feels like a justification to continue. You know, it's like when someone's like Jewish identity is like only based on anti-Semitism or something, and they don't even like believe in God, but they do believe that there's people out to get them and stuff. It's like, yeah. And that's their only remaining article of faith, you know? And it's just like, I don't know. It's kind of sick.
Yeah. That the whole like sort of like woke thing, I think, is really bad and dangerous in that way, because it's like, you're just essentializing yourself. And it's also a weird thing too, because in Native cosmology, there's no sort of essentialized, and you could say part of it is a lack of exposure, but there's no essentialized belief that technology is inherently unnatural, you know, within many different strains of thought. So it's like ways to naturalize things. Yeah.
Anything about like seeding ideas of like mastery and excellence to whites is just like the ultimate fail, where it's just like, totally. What? Like, why would that be exclusive to fucking European, you know, like, you know, shit, like when woke stuff like tries to make it so that like, you know, just like, any hierarchy or any like exertion of, you know, mastery and will or whatever. It's like, no, yeah. You're like poisoning yourself to spite, you know, it's just like,
yeah. But then there's this whole claim that like what you're fed is poison to begin with. So why not take the poisoning into your, like, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm sympathetic to it, but it's also like, If you look at the rational adults in the room, they're like, let me build the skyscraper. You know what I mean? Like, let me do it.
You could use alchemical metaphors and be like, this person's trying to like do the difficult work of transmuting that, like that poison at that state into something. And these people are trying to like start with something that's not a poison. And they're both at different places, so they have access to the poison and the non-poison. But poison is the best antidote, and whatever, you know, like, I don't know. It's like, yes, I can understand how, I guess, like, yeah, I guess it's like this kind of meta question of like a fight fire with fire thing, or like a fight. I don't know. Yeah, it's hard. It's like people who like inherit some kind of thing that has toxic elements within it, but it's still going to help them get out of their situation, you know. So it's like someone's going to use like. Yeah, I mean, it's like, even if you think about shit that's like, you know, like, I don't know, just the way that like different like social technologies, like if someone needed to use Scientology in prison to like make their mind stronger to handle the, you know, like the terror of it or something, it's like it'll work. And then like there's other parts of it that don't work.
Right. You could almost see that with technology too. Like the way, you know, like there's this whole thing like get online to get offline, instead of just like orienting the internet to better suit the things that you need. There's, I think it's like any time that people want to cede territory, I think that is established already. I think that's really dangerous. Like, I think that's a really dangerous impulse, that it's very hipster too. You know, if you look at like, what does a hipster revival entail on a hard economic material level? It's basically just this affirmation that human excellency can exist. We've ceded that to computation, but also like these sort of like computerized versions of social organization are not helping you be the slacker that you want to be in the first place. So you end up just working a service industry job in a huge fucking city like LA or New York and making shitty music because you're not, you don't have the time to make good music anyway. Like, it's not, you know, there's no element of contemplation to that. And I think, so like I was saying earlier, like any seeding of that is really murky.
Yeah. It's hard because it's like, I'm still in one way open to this idea of like forced national service for everyone as a kind of thing that like creates a sense of shared identity, and not necessarily, you know, purely military service or whatever, but just like sort of this kind of like bond between all Americans that like right. All Americans have like worked 2 years.
That's what Fukuyama talks about.
But it's also just like knowing our fucking system. This is where it's like, yeah, this does conflict with the, you know, some of the stuff you learn with the parapolitics angles, because you're just like, fuck, like what would be done in that? You know, like, is it just like, you know, like people being experimentally poisoned and whatever? Like,
well, this is kind of what Ed Berg talks about, is like decoupling the idea of America as being, you know, like fundamentally two different things. Like the United States are very different than America. And it, you know, he has this kind of like, you know, there's like this Deleuzian kind of logic to that, that America is, you know, it can, as people say, you know, there's that meme, America, Infinity America, it contains multitudes. It's very like Walt Whitman-esque, which I subscribe to. So it's almost like, how do you build like a communal America within the captured, you know, disposition of the United States, where like nothing is possible. Like, it's kind of weird because like when you go to Texas, you're almost like, huh, things work really well here. And why not? It's like, well, part of it is because it's privatized. Part of it is because there's still like this civic identity that Texas is like not a part of the rest of the United States. It sees itself as like very different, especially from like, you know, Yankee cities and Yankee states, for example. And I think like creating that schism of difference between Americans and the United States, that's going to be like, I think, a new ground for an American cultural renaissance. It has to come from that like place of absolute skepticism, though. It can't be, which is why like the DSA is such an abject failure, in that it asserts that the state is going to do what it wants you to do, even though it will do some sort of like superficial critique of the CIA or FBI. And, you know, like they're talking about Promise Software on Netflix now. I mean, it's a done deal, you know, like white propaganda is everywhere, but they can like, you know, partially overlook it a little bit. And this is kind of why I think parapolitics, those guys are good, is because they actually like hold these statist, pro-statist forms of like, I don't know, American leftism. And it's like, who is subscribing to Jacobin? Like, you know, it's also really weird because you see these like Jacobin like accounts of guys who write for Jacobin, and it's like, or girls, and they'll just tweet out some like middling observation. It'll get like 2.3K likes and retweets, or like some, and it is really weird because the one time I wrote for a large magazine, you know, I got my feet in there, which is, I'm not going to name names, but involves Peter Matheson, the CIA, a lot of, you know, anti-Soviet propaganda for like the liberalization of language and the arts, you know, like it's got some shady, but I was like, oh, you know, foot's in the door. Let's check this out. As soon as that hit, I had all these accounts tweeting about it, like using familiar tone, like they knew me personally, but we were not mutuals. We'd never interacted before. Like these machines are large and they're really supported essentially by nothing. So it's fucking, yeah. And that like gave me the ick, honestly. It kind of creeped me out. I was like, ooh, man, you know, it's tough.
I know. I view the parapolitics, that whole thing as just, I think the good side of it, when it's, you know, the less sensational side of it, is just like a very useful and necessary accounting kind of. They're really good. Just like, it's like a historical accounting that keeps us, you know, sharp and keeps us like kind of aware of potential, ways that things can be used for whatever nefarious ends. Obviously, I think the extreme version of over intake of that kind of stuff is whatever, you know, like whatever the critique of it would be, like it's like a form of Gnosticism, and then like everything becomes evil and you can't, yeah, like you can't accept anything as, and so yeah, like the extreme version of it is I can see the way that it would be like disempowering or disabilitating or whatever, but like no, I think it's really necessary.
I don't think it's disabilitating. I think this like Mark Fisherism stuff that's kind of peddled by, I think when you say you don't like the state, but you want to give into it in this weird way, you know, it's similar to stuff like, you know, like I'm not going to name names, but one of the people who is kind of like, I don't know, you could say like the gatekeeper of Mark Fisher's legacy, like broke, like sort of like unfollowed me on something that fucking means anything, but got mad because like I refused to defend the dignity of Pitchfork journalists as, you know, some kind of, I don't know, better alternative to algorithms, which basically is, it kind of like goes to show these people's fatalism, that there is no free will whatsoever in deciding what you want, even with algorithmic control. So you need some like, you know, vanguard Pitchfork journalist who's better at doing it because you can't do it for yourself. Like, I don't buy into that. I think increasingly people don't know what they want. I think desires become more convoluted. But to say that there is, that we have none left, is just, that's just false. You know, that just is like saying, that's just offloading responsibility, basically. To who?
Yeah. Yeah.
A fucking Pitchfork writer? Like, I've played in bands my whole, like, forever. I've been in Pitchfork bands giving us 8.2s and whatnot. Like, we always saw them as the enemy. Like, even when they were giving the records good reviews and good press and whatnot, like, we always hated these fucking people. You know, like, we never trusted them. You kidding? Like, why should we trust them? Who are, like, why? What? They're owned by Condé Nast now? We have to trust them even more? That's why all this millennial hipster shit is failing. Because it's literally carries with it the stench of failure. Like, and it has since its inception, really. Like, we should just forget all about it. Like, I would like to memory hole all of this, because it wasn't, you know, this stuff wasn't fundamental in whatever I wanted to do. Like, I've never even heard Justice, I never even heard LCD Sound System before. I don't even know what they sound like. Like, straight up. Like, I don't know, you know, which I think, you know, might be interesting to get into music
That's
stuff.
That's funny. I mean, I remember I went to, like, I saw Steve Aoki play to like 200 people, and fucking, you know, I've been in spaces where there was, where like, when that shit was earlier or whatever, but like, no, I mean, I don't have any kind of desire for that, time period to be held up as, I think it was, not much there to pull from. I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of good things about orienting oneself towards the future. But I think if one is oriented towards the past, that's not the particular, it's not a particularly rich zone culturally.
Yeah. And especially this kind of past. I mean,
it's dry. Yeah. Dry. It's very dry.
But, you know, there's all this kind of, you know, speculative talk amongst, I don't know, you can say cultural zeitgeist people who are saying, you know, country music's back. And I saw this thing with Rick Beato where he's like, guitar music, there are guitars in 56% of songs now that are charting versus zero. And he's saying that trap beats are kind of on the decline, that I think country music takes up 27% of the Billboard Top 150. And I, you know, I think that's interesting, but I don't think that has to do with things. I think people are just looking stylistically at what has established itself as, you know, something that has, like, I don't know, like, I don't want to say human feeling or whatever, but there's a distinction between that, because it also comes from memory. Like, I just read the Mickey Newbury biography, and he talks a lot from memory. And I think memory is going to, especially in this, like, really bloated information age, memory is going to help us navigate where we need to go. And there has to be a kind of respect for that. So I don't know if what your thoughts are about that.
I don't know. Right now, with like some of the stuff around country, I think I can, like, see this really annoying, like, meta narrative sort of playing out, where it's going to be like, I don't know, all the stuff around, like, the Beyonce, why is this not recognized as country stuff, or, like, which I think is just really tiresome, kind of, like, you know, purposely designed to be like this kind of, like, there needs to be a reckoning in country, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I definitely do think that there's a lot of, like, kind of ridiculous separation between R&B and country that is artificial historically. But at this point in time, I'm very, like, kind of just suspicious of it. Just I don't like this kind of, like, battering ram, like, single artist as entire, like, issue thing, which I feel like is, you know, it gives the artist, like, it's like a psyop equality of, like,
right,
what a Taylor Swift means, or
right,
what a Beyonce
yeah, yeah.
means, or which, like, you know, in the past, that would have been you know,
we wouldn't have been giving it that kind of, like, historical weight.
Exactly. And it also, like, in the past, it would have been, like, more salacious and exciting of, like, oh my God, Madonna did something, whatever, which is, like, I understand why that happened in the 80s and stuff, but it's, like, at this point in time, it's so boring, like, the way that these figures it kind of interact with culture. It's just, like, this kind of I don't know. Yeah, it's really
yeah, it's just super predictable. I mean, it's just,
yeah, I think there's also a lot of genres that, like, just don't have that much life to them. Like, I mean, personally, I think that, yeah, like, the kind of, like, Latin trap sound, like, I've really been sick of that for a long time. So it's definitely, like, refreshing, like, whatever, artists like Peso Pluma or that kind of thing becoming bigger in
yeah.
In Spanish music, like,
I
in
agree.
Terms of, like, having more personality, less algorithmic sounding,
yeah,
less
no.
Drake influenced.
Right.
You know,
well, it's funny because now Peso Pluma is, like, outselling Drake.
Yeah.
Which is,
yeah,
like, absolutely crazy. So it's kind of like this homogenized, I don't know, last sort of, you know, sad man at the end of history is kind of, like, getting overthrown by, like, the historical Chad looking guy who looks like a Mexican trap artist, but, you know, makes corridos instead.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm conflicted on certain aspects with kind of Afropop. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that I like about it, but it also has the same kind of susceptibility to this kind of, like, homogenous, algorithmic aspect. Although I just think it's generally more soothing or pleasant or sexy or chill in a way that is different than Latin trap. I mean, I find just Latin trap, like, it's not annoying enough to be interesting the way that, like, you know, the Brazilian funk stuff is, like,
oh,
crazy.
That's,
you know,
so good.
like, even if you don't like it, it's just like, this is so fucking weird and crazy. Like,
I love
yes,
it.
That's, like, that's
I
some
love,
lit,
I love that
crazy
thing of, like, all the
too.
Kids, like, in the favela, and they're each doing the different sounds. Like, one's doing, like, the, I don't know, like, you know, the percussion, like, tow, 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 and the other
yeah.
one's, like, doing, like, the monkey sounds. And yeah. then somebody's like, this guy kind of looks like a zombie. He's wearing a Cypress Hill t-shirt. Is kind of, you know, casting this, like, weird spell.
Yeah, no, that shit's interesting. It's totally interesting. It's, like, it's weird. It's interesting.
DJ
yeah,
Aranya, you know, like, all that stuff is so cool. That's kind of like, you know, it's kind of weird. It's like, because you look at something like Detroit techno that's made by machines, but it still has, like, way more soul than indie rock or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
It's just
yeah.
like because just contextually you can imagine where it's coming from, and even like the need to escape something. And so there is there's like something very sentimental driving that, you know, which is, I think that there's something to that, you know, and it's like, artists need to remain kind of idealistic in that sense. And, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about it, just, you know, having just been to the Chinati Foundation and seeing like Donald Judd stuff. And, you know, I definitely am like against representation in general. I think you know, when you're talking about like this stuff of like, you know, these discourse machines, like the PSYOP-y Beyonce stuff and Taylor Swift, like, the way to get out of that is just like, just stop looking at technical images of contemporary figures. Like, I really like this thing. Yeah. Somebody created this GitHub script where, like, on X to replace all pictures of Sidney Sweeney with Mao Zedong. Did you see that? So anytime you see Sidney Sweeney on it, it's just like Mao. And then like the background music was just Chief Keef. I was like, yeah, this is my shit right here. Like, nothing against, I mean, she's hot or whatever, but that's another person who clearly, you know, exists to foment this idea of like, is she right wing? Like, is she our person? You know, like, it's just like, who fucking cares?
Stupid instrumental fucking PR campaign fucking bullshit. Yeah, I know, it's
like, even that, like, withholding, you know, at that level, I think, you know, like, there's really no mystery there. It's like, don't you understand this is all for career preservation anyway? Like, even this whole thing of like, I'm not going to say what I really am. It's like, that's opposed to, that's fucking predictable also. When you get to a certain amount of where your image is everywhere, you know, it's just, you know, it's like, just be honest, you know? It's like, Brad Paisley is really weird because he was like this total pro-vaxxer, but he's like said a lot of like anti-left. He's like a high-level Freemason. He was like supporting Ukraine, all this stuff. And he's like, he's also kind of like this like Republican. It's like, I'm almost like more impressed by that than this whole like, I don't know, like feigned mystery thing of like the rock star, which I understand in like a case of like Bowie or Mark Bolan, that was like a different time. That was pretty interesting because there was an actual separation between you and everyone else, but we're so far beyond that point to where it's like the only way you can create that is to just like literally not get famous, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a strange double bind scenario as well. But yeah, we've been going for a while. It's been 90 minutes. How should we wrap this up? I think this is a great thing. We got to do, this was a lot of fucking fun. I haven't had this much fun in forever, honestly. I'm having the time of my life.
Yeah, no, I had a lot of fun. I'm definitely like, I'm stoked to do more in the future and have a little more info in my head at the ready and be able to go, you know, a little more in depth, but I think it was really fun kind of dancing around and yeah, to all these different zones and, yeah.
Yeah. We also have to record soon. I'll be able to come up and do that.
Oh yeah.
So when, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's a lot of fun, you know, we're kind of taking it back to the early days and getting back to our roots here a little bit. And, yeah, no, I think it's a lot of fun. I think there's a lot of, you know, there's still a lot that can be done. And it's just, you know, I think a lot of it just comes from like burnout and being tired. You know, it's like if you're just doing 3 hour long solo things, that's like a lot of work, you know, and it's just sometimes it's just fun to like riff a little bit. And also, yeah, it's like the interview format is kind of dead too, which is why I mostly stopped it, unless it's something I think is like really pertinent. And it's, and that's generally with people nobody know about, so they're not interested. Yeah. And it's,
oh yeah, no, there's a part of the interview thing where it's like, there's things that are really sick about interviewing a little bit more of like a virgin source, where it's like an old person who hasn't given an interview in a really long time,
right,
or something like the, you know,
no, this is great. I'm just looking forward to doing more of this stuff. And, you know, Ebenezer Group is going to make Paranoid Exotica. And
yeah, setting up a studio in Mount Baldy. It's gonna be gonna be sick.
No, it's great. You know, I think there's a lot of good things that can come out of this. It's just it's just kind of taking these different disciplines and not being like multi-hyphenate creative about it, but just sort of, you know, putting together the pieces that actually fit. You know, I think that's a part of it too, is like, I think evolving along those lines rather than this logic of like, oh, I have to evolve along a line that actually like that makes sense from a consumption standpoint. I don't think that's really, I'm just kind of tired of that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. That kills the spirit.
Yeah. So it's all about keeping the spirit alive. So yeah, cool. Ebenezer Group, News Hour.